4th, Cincinnati voters will choose the city's next mayor and whittle 27 candidates down to 9 in the race for city council. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's our 2025 election edition. Our gathering space in Evanston is full right now with a live audience. Welcome to the show. And here on the stage, I'm joined by WVXU senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard. Okay. Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist, Chris Wetterich. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Always great to be here. Thanks.
WVXU local government reporter, Becca Costello. Hi, Becca.
Hello, Lucy.
And Xavier University professor, Mac Mariani. Thanks for joining us, Mac.
Thanks for having me.
We are here to discuss the mayoral and council races, and we're also going to ask how development is factoring into this election. And we want to hear from our studio audience. Where are your questions? And give them to us. What are your questions and thoughts about what's on the ballot? Let's get things started with the race for Cincinnati's mayor. Chris, tell us briefly about each of the candidates for mayor, their background, and their record.
Yeah, Mayor Aftab Purevall is seeking a second term. His profession is a lawyer. He's a lawyer. This is his first term as mayor. Before that, he was clerk of courts for Hamilton County. He ran an unsuccessful race for Congress in 2018. And he lives in Clifton, I believe. The Republican challenger is Corey Bowman. He is a pastor, co-pastor at the River Church in the West End. He also owns a coffee shop called King Arms Coffee, and he has never held elected office. And he is, of course, I think, as we all know, the brother of Vice President J.D. Vance.
Okay. Well, crime and public safety have been such lightning rod issues in this election.
But let's not forget that in the springtime, when there was articles from the media and from those in City Hall saying that crime was down and that they had a handle on it, everybody that lived downtown, had businesses downtown, all knew the same thing, that nothing could be farther from the truth and that this was going to escalate as it was getting warmer. And so what you're seeing right now isn't just out of the blue, something that's catching anybody downtown by surprise. They knew about this. They've actually voiced their concerns to the city hall and the police department, and nothing was taken into account for.
That was Republican Corey Bowman speaking on July 1st on WLW. Becca, briefly walk us through what the crime data is saying now.
Yeah, well, as he mentioned, in the spring, crime was down. There is always a bit of an uptick in crime during the warm months in the summer. And during the press conference kind of leading into the summer months, we did look at that data and crime was down across the city. There was that expected bump in the summer. It was a little higher than it usually is over the summer. And of course, it varies a lot depending on the neighborhood or the police district. Looking at the most recent data, this is through September 20th, year-to-date violent crime across the whole city is down 1.9% compared to last year. Compared to the three-year average year-to-date, violent crime is down about 6%. Now, even then, obviously, there's differences between homicide, rape, robbery, aggravated assault. And of course, the numbers are different when you look at the central business section, for example. Violent crime is up both compared to last year and the three-year average. The main point is crime data is very complicated. It is very common to hear conflicting numbers even from day to day, let alone from week to week. Different media reports might have focus on different parts of the crime data, and that's why things might seem contradictory. But it is true that crime was down earlier this year. It is true that there was a bit of an increase over the summer, especially in some violent crime, especially downtown and at the banks and in parts of over the Rhine. Things have kind of stabilized a little bit, but it varies a lot depending on where in the city we're talking about.
Mac, what do you think about how City Hall and the Cincinnati Police Department have responded to concerns from residents and business owners about crime and public safety?
Well, I think one of the things you see is that certainly after the I don't know if you want to call it a fight, a assault, whatever, however you want to define it, it got a lot of people's attention, and including members of city council, including the mayor. And so, you know, one of the things you saw is that they were sort of slow off the gate, I think, on when it came to city council and the mayor to have sort of a consistent message. It took them a little bit, but then you saw that the September 10th, they passed anti-crime, an additional $5.4 million for, you know, by a vote of 6-3 in city council. They passed a curfew back August 6th. The state city partnership with the governor coming to town and have a joint press conference with the mayor. So there's certainly an effort to like, listen, we want to be visible and demonstrate that we are taking action. I mean, having an election in November certainly helps focus the mind. But there's I think the early response was sort of a bit convoluted, and I think there was some hope, and I can understand this in many ways, that they didn't want this to listen. If we feed this beast, right, we go do press conferences, we go talk about, you know, what happened on what people saw on social media, that takes a one-day story and turns into a three-day story, or excuse me, a five-day story. So there's a reluctance to do that, and one of the results is that I think people sort of took that as a sign of indifference and a sign of, oh, you don't really have a clear plan for how to address things like this. I also think there's probably a disconnect between numbers, right? A 6% drop. People don't feel a 6% drop. What they feel is the level of crime year to year. The absolute numbers are things that we pay more attention to. Our perceptions are certainly also shaped by social media, and probably not a week goes by where we don't see four or five violent crimes on our social media. Even if they don't happen immediately in Cincinnati, we hear about them and we learn about them. So there's a lot of different factors that go into how people feel about crime. Reality matters. But the way people perceive it is also, they don't perceive the sense of order that they used to feel, I think.
Chris, anything you want to add about how City Hall has responded specifically to some of these issues?
You know, I think there's been some confusion as to some of the measures, the ending the food trucks at 11 p.m. You know, there's some questions, I think, even from council members about the data surrounding that, plus the red bike, the banning of that after certain hours as well. So there are some things that seem a little bit more vibes based than, you know, stuff that I think the police said this would make our job easier. And I think that some of the constituencies around those two things were kind of taken aback and said, well, we weren't really consulted by that, and particularly the food trucks.
Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purival has fielded a lot of questions about crime in recent months.
We focused a lot on crime data throughout the summer. I don't think I've focused enough on reaffirming people's feelings. If you feel unsafe, irrespective of what the data says, that's a problem. That's a problem for me to solve. And that's why we're here and continuing to be here with these interventions.
That was from August 13th at a press availability. Mac, you talked about perceptions and how those perceptions matter and how they can be different from what the numbers show. Can you talk a little bit more about those perceptions and whether people feel safe in their neighborhoods? Does that vary from neighborhood to neighborhood?
Sure. I think it does. And, you know, one of the things is the location matters a lot, right? So when you have, one of the things that that city council did, or Cincinnati did, was to put a fence around the banks, right? There's too much crime, right? So we're going to put a fence around the banks so we can, figure out who's coming in and who's coming out. That, you know, sort of indicates, listen, we don't actually have control of this, right? So these sort of, you start to see this. I think that there's also where crime happens matters. So when it happens, you know, my day drinking is down 6% this year, right? But I'm drinking on my porch constantly. So when people go, in my neighborhood, ask about my day drinking, they're like, it's way up, right? And so, where things happen matter, but I've been tracking and it's down, right? It's way down. But what happened? Downtown's our front porch, right? That's downtown, the banks. That's where everybody in the city goes. So regardless of what's happening in your neighborhood, even if you feel safe in Hyde Park or you feel safe at Clifton, if you go downtown and you don't feel safe downtown because the crime is actually up there. So that's a big part of it.
Yeah. Howard, we haven't heard from you yet. What about these feelings about crime and public safety? Is this something that's an issue every council race or every mayoral election? How is this something that comes up over and over again?
Yes, it does. Is this working, actually?
Yes, okay. That's great.
Yes, it does, but it's much more intense this time around. And Mac's right. I mean, it's a matter of where you go and where you are. If you're on the streets at 3 a.m. on a Friday night in downtown Cincinnati and something bad happens, well, you have to ask yourself, why are you there? And it's places like the banks and the downtown area in general. People have a misperception about it. And I think politics is starting to drive a lot of that. Politics in terms of the council race and the mayoral race. You know, the mayoral candidate, Bowman, who has made the most out of this, had a town hall type meeting on this subject a while back, and he held it in Norwood. He did, at the Mound Cafe. And I don't know who was there and who it drew, but, you know, if you're going to talk about crime in the city of Cincinnati, you might as well talk about it in the city of Cincinnati. And that makes me wonder how much of this is just pure politics and how much of it is a serious concern. I mean, you know, I don't want to downplay people's fears about crime because those are legitimate. But I also don't want to give credit to politicians who take advantage of that and are more than willing to distort the picture.
Well, Chris, how has Mayor Purval been talking about his relationship with police? And do you have a sense for how that compares with how Corey Bowman is, what he's saying on the campaign trail about how he would work with police?
There have been a number of exchanges between... not even between the two of them, but, you know, in relation to each other. I mean, I think Corey Bowman has said things like, well, they're holding the police back. The police can't do their job the way that they should do it. There've been orders given, you know, very, very it's kind of like nailing applesauce to the wall. There's not very specific in terms of what we're actually talking about. And a few, Becca might correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it was either weeks ago or maybe more than a month, the mayor had the police chief up at the EPA council. And, you know, I think he asked her point blank, have I ever told you to tell our cops not to enforce stuff? And the answer was no. And that's an exchange you would expect to have happen. The mayor is not the boss of the police chief under our system of government, but he does have, you know, there's historically, you know, some relationship there of authority, even though the police chief can only be fired by the city manager. So, you know, I think this will continue to be an issue, and I think we'll hear more about it as the two of them gear up here.
Becca, do you feel like you've seen the mayor and police chief aligned pretty closely through this summer and these concerns about crime and public safety?
I think so, and I don't think that's unique to this summer. I think they've been closely aligned from the beginning. You know, it seems like Mayor Purval has tried to take a bit of a tougher stance on crime this summer compared to previous years. You know, this idea that it's the top priority and that they are, you know, really pushing all resources into that and that they're willing to take really, you know, really any measures. Drones are something that's relatively new to the Cincinnati Police Department. They've used it in very small ways as a pilot program for a couple of years, but they've really expanded it this year. For example, at a press conference when they were talking about that, and I kind of pushed on the privacy concerns about that, he kind of said, I will do anything it takes to protect the people of Cincinnati and reduce crime. I'm not sure if that's a stance that would have been quite so open a couple years ago when crime wasn't such a big headline in the city right now. But to your question, I do think the mayor and the chief have been closely aligned. He's been very supportive of the chief. Some candidates for city council, for example, have called for the chief to be fired or to resign, and the mayor has been fully backing her all the way.
Well, I want to remind our audience, we're happy to get your questions too. If you've got questions, just raise your hand and flag down either Harper or Jen. Chris, some members of the local police union did take a vote of no confidence in the mayor. What did you make of that? Do you think that's going to be a factor in the election?
No, I don't think it'll be a factor. It's not surprising. You know, the police union it's an unusual organization in respect to other labor unions in that it has veterans of the force who are not currently police officers. They are allowed to vote in those types of decisions. And, you know, candidly, a lot of the retired police officers have been there a long time, and they're, you know, they're kind of hostile towards the mayor's political outlook, I think. So I wasn't surprised to see it. The police union's endorsement as a force in city politics is not what it once was.
Did you want to add to that, Howard? I see you holding the microphone.
No, I agree with Chris entirely. I mean, it was not even representative of the Queen City Lodge of the FOP. I mean, it was basically, as I understand it, mostly retirees. And I really, in all my years covering politics, I can, those kind of endorsements or non-endorsements or votes of no confidence very rarely have a big impact on how voters respond.
Jen, did we have a question?
Hi, yes, I'm Dottie. My question is, how much do you think national influence is going to come to Cincinnati and how we should think about the mayoral race with that, like with him, J.D. Vance's brother, threats to send military to Democratic cities, all that kind of stuff. How do you think that might play out with the mayoral race?
Thanks, Dottie. Who wants to take that one? You want to go for it, Mac?
Sure. You know, I think obviously Bowman being the half brother of the vice president makes this a race of somewhat national interest. And certainly, you know, he's the first Republican, you know, if you think you look back, I mean, I don't think it's been since 2007 when we've had an actual Republican candidate, in the general election for mayor. Back then that was Brad Wenstrup. And, you know, when it was, Wenstrup actually won 46% of the vote, but this, you know, this is, you know, 18 years ago or whatever it was. It's hard to believe that there's a Republican would get 46% of the vote in this environment, right? Partly it's in the environment and partly the city's changed. It's much more Democratic. You know, if you look back to 2004, the previous presidential election from the Wenstrup race, I think the Democrats won handily 69% of the vote. But, you know, now you look at Harris's percent was 77%, right? It's 69% is a ridiculously high percentage of the vote. And they've increased that by 8%, you know, in the last 20 years. And probably if you look back at the Obama years, even more. So it's just a much more Democratic city. So, you know, regardless of the national attention, regardless of the money, there's just not enough Republicans for this race to be even close. Now, the key question is, I think that we probably have to ask ourselves is, you know, what do both of these candidates do next, right? You know, how does this race, will Bowman run for something else? You know, Wenstrup overperformed in that race. He lost, but obviously went on to have a career as a member of Congress, right? And so, you know, is that a potential for Bowman down the line? Is there something after this for him? For the mayor, there's fewer opportunities statewide, certainly because it's a more Republican state, but there's, you know, in a really good Democratic year, there's obviously hope for a Democrat. So the one question I'd have is, you know, does he underperform in this race, and how does that affect his, you know, his potential as either a statewide candidate or congressional candidate down the line? Probably a congressional candidate, he'd be fine depending on what the district looked like.
Howard, I know you're itching to jump in here, but before you do, Corey Bowman has some thoughts on this. He talks about this. It's important to consider the working relationship between the mayor and council. Here's what Corey Bowman says about that relationship, and he kind of touches on some of the points Dottie brings up.
This is a cabal of 9 council members and a mayor that have been endorsed by the Democratic Party, where there are more qualified people that are actually running, even as Democrats in this race, that didn't even get looked at because they want the things to remain the way they are. And so this has to be a collaborative effort of people that might disagree on national issues, but we got to come together and say, this is a city election. This is not a national election. This is not even a state election. This is an election that is going to impact the crime, the infrastructure, and the budget of our city. And we have to come together and be on board with that.
So that, again, is from that July 1st interview on WLW. Howard, you want to weigh in?
Sure. I wrote very early on in this thing a column at WBXU.org about Bowman and Bowman getting into this race. And I have not believed for a minute that his candidacy was ultimately about the mayorship of Cincinnati. I think there's another act to be played here. And, you know, if you go back to 2007 and Brad Winsler taking on Mark Mallory, who had some problems, but was still, you know, a Mallory, and that was, you know, a great political name in Cincinnati. And the Republican Party had no one else who wanted to mess with Mark Mallory, and Brad Winsler stepped in and did. And he ran a credible campaign. He got something like, well, it was 46% of the vote. And the party rewarded him for his loyalty, and he ended up in Congress for a very long time. This has not been lost on Greg Landsman. You know, he's been watching this out of the corner of his eye for quite some time. And if you look at the people who've supported Bowman's campaign, many of them match up pretty well with the kind of MAGA right money types. You know, he went down to Florida and held some fundraisers and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's not about this mayor's race necessarily. If he wins, he wins.
Well, up next, 26 candidates and 26 plus a write-in. So 27 candidates and 9 seats on Cincinnati City Council. Who's running? What are their positions? That's next. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're live for our 2025 Politics Edition with a studio audience in our headquarters in Evanston. We turn now to the race for Cincinnati City Council with WVXU's Howard Wilkinson and Becca Costello, Xavier University Professor Mac Mariani, and the Cincinnati Business Courier's Chris Wetterick. Thanks for sticking with us, panelists. Becca, we have 26 candidates on the ballot for council in November, plus a write-in. Name them all. Just kidding. we can't talk about each of them individually tonight. You've sent questions, though, to all the candidates. What themes are you seeing emerge so far from the responses you've gotten back?
I really see a lot of similarities to the 2021 council race, which was the last time we had this many candidates on the ballot. Actually, we had 10 more candidates than we do this year in 2021. The big issue that year was corruption. It was so soon after the arrests of 3 city council members. That was such a huge a trust issue. This time around, I think it is again a trust issue, but not about corruption. It's really about the decisions that this current city council and mayor have made. It's a lot about community engagement. It's a lot about development. There were 2 major things. We've already talked about them tonight. The connected community zoning reform that was somewhat unpopular among certain residents of Cincinnati. The Hyde Park Square development, which was very unpopular and really kind of galvanized a grassroots movement to put it on the ballot. Of course, it will not be on the ballot anymore. Those are some of the issues where I think we see a theme of candidates who decided to run because they say they feel like the current council is not listening to residents, and they are promising to be the candidate that will listen to residents. I will say I think there's not a lot of substance necessarily so far. That's not uncommon, but I think it's kind of unclear until you're actually in the office what that actually looks like, you know, what it means to do community engagement, what good community engagement looks like. You know, we've had different candidates have pitched different ideas, but I think that the main theme here is that a lot of candidates have decided to run because they feel the current council has lost trust in the public. Now, we'll see with the results if that's the case. As our digital editor often says, Twitter is not real life. I guess X now.
It's not even Twitter anymore.
So we'll see how much of the, you know, if this is a vocal minority or if it really is representative across the electorate in Cincinnati.
Chris, how are these new candidates, these people who aren't incumbents, are they giving a clear message of how they would want to change course at City Hall?
Some of them are. I mean, I feel like the Charter Committee's message, Becca kind of alluded to this, is we will listen to you. The question is, which you, which people, which community council, which, you know, what does that really mean? And, you know, and I think you kind of can categorize these folks into, you know, the people most likely to get on there. And I think there's, you know, two or three very, you know, pretty strong charter candidates, Lakita Cole, Steve Gooden, and Don Driehaus. And then you have kind of the two heavyweight challengers who are not in council now, but have been previously, Liz Keating and Christopher Smitherman. And, you know, one thing that I've heard as I've interviewed 10 of, you know, 10 of the 10 of this group, you know, I think four or five charterites slash Smitherman or slash Keating, and then, some of the incumbents as well. And the unifying thing that, you know, it's interesting about the Hyde Park Square development is everybody who wasn't there says, we would have not let it come to this. We would not have let it, you know, come to a vote and got this rancorous. And so I think that's kind of an interesting statement, an interesting way of looking at that. So,
well, speaking of engagement, we want to hear from our audience. So what are your questions for this race about city council? If you've got some, raise your hand. I see a hand there in the back, and one of our colleagues will come meet with you. Chris, you just mentioned some well-known names, people who are running as Republicans, charterites, Christopher Smitherman's running as an independent. Do you see this as a political wake-up call for council?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wrote a column basically saying that, that, you know, both the development issue generally, not just Hyde Park Square, and then also crime and quality of life issues. You know, a number of the candidates have, as I've talked to them, have brought up the snow from this past winter. And Liz Keating, for example, said, you know, look, it took them 4 days, 5 days, you know, to get this cleared out. And, you know, we had the kids home from school for 4 days. We couldn't easily get to work for several days. And so, snow has been a big problem in other cities when it's not cleared. I don't know what our expectations are in Cincinnati. I've never viewed it as a particularly competent snow clearing city, but, but we haven't had a lot of big snows. And so people have expectations about, you know, city services. And so I'm hearing that as well, that basic city services need to be better. And that's the thing that I have heard in the 12 years that I've been back here. You know, people are never really satisfied with the way that stuff goes, because they look to their suburban neighbors and they see cleared streets of snow. They don't see as much crime, and we can go on and on, but they feel that the quality of life issues are kind of, you know, peaking in a way that we don't like.
Jen?
Hi. My name is actually Nicholas. What do you think the city council can do to encourage youth to not rob, use guns or anything like that? Because I know that this city has a huge youth
violence, youth crime.
And it's been an issue for a while. And I know that it's been that it's been on the news quite a bit.
Well, thank you, Nicholas.
Sure.
Mac, I'm going to let, do you have thoughts on that? You work at a college. You see some unruly youths, I bet.
I don't see too many.
Yeah.
You know, I think the parties have very different views on this, right? And you know, I the charterites are going to be a bit mixed because they're sort of coming from all different directions there. But I think, you know, and you could see this partly in the rhetoric. You see there was some division in the unified city council that we have when it came to the money that was spent, the $5.4 million for anti-crime initiatives, right? With the idea that, like, listen, we need, you know, from some Democrats would say, we need to be doing more to give youth, you know, young people things to do and job training and opportunities outside of, you know, outside of, you know, the streets where they're
sort of the root causes argument.
The root causes argument, right? And, you know, and I think that when you look at the Republican rhetoric, right, it'd be like, well, you know, you commit a crime with a gun, you go to jail. And then you're not committing more crimes with guns because you're not there. You know, you're not out there doing stuff. And that, you know, that's sort of the two different approaches, right? You could see that with our, you know, the Republican DAs took a much, much harder line on this, at least rhetorically. And I guess we have to see how that plays out.
It looks like we have another question from our audience.
Hi, I'm Jackie Gruer. I'm a member of CUFA, Communities United for Action, and we have been working with community engagement for several years now and trying to promote it. And we see that the city has hired people to be community in charge of community engagement, but these people are not funded. They don't have any funds to work with. And there are people out there that have studied community engagement. There are ways to enact it. And the people who have been hired have not accessed any funds to access to that. Connected communities is a wonderful thing. I thought it was great. I went to three community engagement sessions. They were poorly attended. People didn't know about them. And so it's really hard to see how the effort is going into community engagement. That's my question.
Yeah. Becca or Chris, do either of you have thoughts on that? I don't know if either of you have looked into funding for community engagement or that department.
It's a little bit of a can of worms. I don't think we have time to go into too much of the detail there. I also attended several of the Connected Communities engagement sessions, including one in my own neighborhood in Price Hill. I think right now community engagement is housed within the Department of Planning. It is called the Department of Planning and Engagement. And for that reason, a lot of the engagement efforts, I think, at least the more public ones, have been geared at development projects. Of course, there are lots of issues that the city should engage the community on that are not just development related or zoning related. So I do think that there's been some criticism from the community about there not being a more comprehensive kind of approach to planning or to engagement, to community engagement. I don't have the numbers in front of me in terms of the funding. The Department of Planning and Engagement obviously does have funding. I don't know what slice of that pie goes specifically to community engagement. I don't think it's nothing. I mean, it the number of staff that were involved in the Connected Communities, for example, I think that costs some money to be out that many times. Now, the question is, how effective was it? And do people feel like they were engaged? But the effort was there. And I do think that it wasn't cheap to do that. But again, the question comes down to, was it effective? Does the community feel like they were heard? And obviously, many people say they do not feel like they were heard. Yeah. I don't know that really gets to the question. I'm sorry.
Sure, there's always the question of whether it's enough money and whether it's being spent the right way. There's another question from the audience, I think.
Tim Krauss, you started the segment talking about the disconnect between citizens and their elected representatives. To what extent could we attribute that to this at large voting system we have versus districts or versus a preferential choice like
ranked choice
kind of thing? Yeah, ranked choice voting. Mm-hmm. Would that make a difference? And because there is this disconnect and you have so many candidates running, is there discussion going on about the antiquated nature of an at-large system?
I think that's such an interesting question. Howard, I feel like that has your name written all over it.
Yes, I have addressed this before. Tim, I think really, I mean, we're getting to the point where we got to start thinking again about some kind of ranked choice voting. We had it in the city for many years. It was not called ranked choice voting, but that's what it amounted to. And we had a much more representative body that came out of that voting system. I don't know what it's going to take to do that because, it used to be the Charter Committee was their foundation. That was what they believed in more than anything else. And I think they've pretty much abandoned that now because you don't hear any of these five candidates that they've endorsed this year talking about that. You've got a Republican, you got a Democrat, you got couple of, you know, more independent people, but that's not what they're talking about anymore. And, you know, when Marion Spencer was alive, that's all they talked about. You know, and God bless her. I mean, she, you know, she would not let it go, and, you know, till her dying day. And, you know, she used to tell me, she said, no, it's not that complicated. It just takes a while to do the counting. You know, she said, you don't know how your TV set works, but you know that when you turn it on, you get a picture. That's the way PR was. That's the way proportional representation was. And I think we really seriously got to start thinking about that again.
Chris, did you want to add something real quick?
Yeah. Steve Gooden, who is, they have a name for it.
Convener.
Yeah. Means leader of the charter committee. He has started to talk about it. In fact, I think he thought that this might be something they would try to put it on the ballot this year. They, you know, for whatever reason, they haven't. I think it's something they're interested in, as I've talked to some of their members. I have both lived and worked under districts and under, you know, under the system that we have, obviously. And to address the other part of the question, you know, a district election does bring, it would probably mean a less expensive council race for individual members. And it would also, you know, bring those folks closer to the community. The flip side of it is that people who represent a community will never vote for something if it's opposed by their community. Even if it's in the best interests of the city overall, that's something I saw time and time again in other communities where they did have district elections. So there's, the grass is always greener, but there's a flip side to everything.
And just real briefly,
That we can't hear you, Howard.
The question would become, who draws those districts?
Oh, yeah. We don't have to talk
which
about
neighborhoods
that.
And which districts?
We deal with this whole redistrict.
Can we put Westwood and Hyde Park in the same
right.
district? That would.
Okay, hold your powder. Hold your powder. We're going to take a quick break. I want to let you all know we have invited all the city council candidates to talk with us on Cincinnati Edition, and those interviews will start next week. Be sure to tune in. Up next, one of the biggest factors in Cincinnati's election might be development. We'll hear why after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. The three D's, development, development, development. Is it a factor in how you'll vote in Cincinnati's election? I'm Lucy May, back with Cincinnati Edition Live, the Politics Edition. Our studio audience is here, and we're joined by WVXU's Becca Costello and Howard Wilkinson, Xavier University professor Mac Mariani, and the Cincinnati Business Courier's Chris Wetterich. The debate and fallout over a proposed development in Hyde Park Square could be a big factor in how Cincinnati neighbors will choose City Hall's next leaders. Of course, we want to continue to hear from our audience. Looks like we already have a question. Okay.
So hi, everyone. My name is Kira. I'm actually one of Dr. Mariani's students, so hi.
Hi, Kira.
Yeah, so my question pertains to, like, with the amount of, like, hot-button issues that we're seeing on the ballot this election cycle, how do you think that's going to affect voter turnout, especially among people my generation, and how that is going to impact the city council race?
That's very interesting. I'm going to let you take that one, Mac. It seems like a plant.
Yeah, sure, it might be. I'm sadly unprepared for it. On the one hand, I think that, you know, we've seen sort of an uptick of interest, right? Certainly people are talking about this stuff. And as you could see, city council and the mayor are trying to be responsive, right? We know people care about these issues, whether it's Hyde Park, whether it's crime. And we're going to try to take action. We're going to try to look like we want to change perceptions. And certainly you also see on the other side, the Republicans in the Charter Committee trying to take advantage of that. So there has been a lot. But if you look at the primary, right, the primary kind of predated a lot of this stuff, right? Our turnout in the primary was 22,000 votes, which is about a third down from what it was previously.
22,000
right?
votes.
Yeah. So it's 10%, only 10% turnout in the primary. Now, that I think could be one factor in that is that you had a Republican versus a Democrat. You know, it was seen as sort of a Republican versus a Democrat. And I think when there's more than one sort of credible Democrat, there's actually more turnout, right? Because there's more Democrats here, right? So that might be a factor. So it will be interesting to see if people show up. We were talking about civic engagement the other day, right? Well, now we've certainly got some issues that people ought to care about. They certainly are informed about them. I think almost everybody has an opinion on these things. They've heard about them, which is good. And that's in part due to the work the journalists are doing, right? But now you have to actually show up.
So, you know, one of those hot button issues is the Hyde Park Square development. Chris, what's the latest on that project and where it stands? Becca referenced earlier, it was maybe going to be on the ballot. It's not going to be on the ballot, but tell us the latest.
So at the 11th hour, and I was on vacation in Florida, so I didn't see this in firsthand, but at the 11th hour, the developer came in and asked the city to repeal the ordinance, which would allow them to have built, it was a $150 million project, more than 100 apartments, hotel, retail, et cetera. And so that by repealing that ordinance, the council took it off the ballot, basically, or took it out of play for the ballot. So it is pending. You know, we don't know. The developer has the next move, I guess you would say. They could resubmit a different plan. They could resubmit a tweak plan. They could do any number of things. And so we're waiting to see what happens.
Well, you know, we've talked a bit about how all the council members are Democrats. The mayor's a Democrat, but council was divided on this issue. Becca, can you talk just briefly about how incumbent council members voted on this project, how they explained their votes? There was a bit of a rift.
Yeah, the vote was 7-2. There were only two council members who opposed it, and those were Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney and Scotty Johnson. Their reasoning was pretty straightforward. They said, we heard loud and clear from the community they don't want it, and that was all they based their vote on. And that was a significant enough for them to vote against it. The others, criticized the community engagement process, but said ultimately the city needs housing, and it really kind of came down to that for those council members. There's a bit of a range there of some who said, well, I wish the project was different, but I'm going to support it. Some said, I think this is a great project. So a bit of a range there, and then of course all council members voted in favor of the repeal because it was requested by the developer.
Here's what Mayor Purval has said about where this whole project ended up.
No housing development is going to be perfect and appease every resident, but what happens in one neighborhood does have an impact citywide. And what concerns me is the chilling effect on the overall city for development. It's already very difficult to build housing, period. How do we work together to make it easier to build the housing that is critical for not future residents, but for residents right now in Cincinnati who can't afford to pay their rent or their property taxes?
That was the mayor on September 4th. Jen, I think we have another question from the audience.
I have a question. That goes back to the issue of rank order voting. I understand at the state level, there is a strong emphasis to basically outlaw any effort at the city or county level to move in the direction of rank order voting. Can you verify that? And can you say what are the possibilities that will come about?
I'm going to ask our panel real quickly if anybody knows a lot about that. Okay, could you answer as briefly as possible? I know it's very complicated, okay, but we're running out of time.
Here's the deal. The Republicans in the state legislature want to outlaw that. If I were the Republicans in the major urban areas, I would say, no, don't do that. That's the only chance we have of getting a foothold in the city council in heavily Democratic cities. But if the Republicans in the legislature want to do that, they'll do it because they have the votes.
Well, there you go. Jen, you have another question.
Jeannie Ruggieri, my question is about tax abatements. How many more tax abatements can the city support? Because the developers get off the hook and the homeowners continue to get stuck paying the bills.
Great question. Is that something, Chris, that you've looked into? Okay.
They did the city council. I believe I don't know if it was in this term or the previous term, but they did change the tax abatement process for they group neighborhoods together, and basically to cut this short, some neighborhoods are eligible for higher tax abatements. Those are the ones that haven't had as much development, and then other neighborhoods, particularly on the east side, they are eligible for much lower levels of tax abatements.
Just residential tax.
Residential. I'm sorry. To be clear, yeah, and they're kind of looking to see how that works. I think. I think those neighborhoods are set to be revised periodically. I don't think that has happened yet. But that's kind of where it stands. I don't see politically where they would do away with any, you know, tax abatements altogether.
Jen, we have another question.
Hello, my name is Ellis, and I was going to ask, are apartments in Hyde Park Square really going to benefit the people that we need to have housing? Like, are they going to, from my experience in Hyde Park, it's not going to be affordable. Okay. So, and I think that that's what we need more of, and is that going to be included in that?
Thank you, Ellis. Do we know about the price points of those apartments?
They are market rate. They will not be income restricted.
I'll just say the argument, and first of all, we're not running for city council. So. the argument is a supply and demand argument, is that the part of the reason that rents are so high and are getting higher is because there's more demand than there is supply. So it's the idea that even apartments that are not affordable, for those of us who are lower income or middle income, but that the more supply there is, it will decrease the demand. But to answer your question, these are not going to be affordable apartments. That is, and they've never said that it would be.
Okay, we are running short on time. I've got a final question for each of my panelists. You each have 10 seconds to answer. So that's right. So do you think the community feels heard by these candidates? Mac, you get to go first.
I think one of the challenges is the it's virtually unprecedented to have 9 Democrats, all 9 seats held by one party. And I think that creates a problem because there's less of a sense that there's sort of disagreement, and disagreement helps to make people feel heard.
Chris?
It's too early to tell. The campaign has literally just begun, I think, for a lot of these folks.
Wow, party pooper.
Sorry.
Howard?
Just one piece of advice. Every one of you lives in a neighborhood. Many of you in Cincinnati. Go to your community councils when they have a candidate's night and get up and grill these people on the issues that actually make difference to you.
Becca?
I think the thing I lose sleep over is the low voter turnout, and it's the people who are not talking. They're not listening. They're not talking. They're not engaged. And those are people who will be just as affected by the policies of the next mayor and city council. That doesn't answer your question. I just wanted to be angsty for a minute.
Fair enough. If
We're
you
not
have more
answer
questions,
your question. I think yeah.
If you have more questions about the election, you'll want to tune in starting next week. We've invited all the city council candidates to our show for one-on-one interviews. We're later going to be talking to Mayor Aftab Pureval about his campaign, and the offer still stands for Republican candidate Corey Bowman to join me one-on-one. Pastor Bowman, call me. Some dates to remember. Early voting starts October 7th. Election day is Tuesday, November 4th. I want to thank our panelists, Howard Wilkinson and Becca Costello with WVXU, Professor Mac Mariani with Xavier University, and Chris Wetterick with the Cincinnati Business Courier. Special thanks to our volunteers at WVXU and to our studio audience. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors are Carlos Lopez-Cornu and Stephen Baum. I'm Lucy May. Get out and vote.